Bob Darrell, I'm an alcoholic.
No.
Can you hear me?
No.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? This is awkward. Glad to be here. Did I say my name?
Yeah.
Okay. I've been sober since October 31st, 1978. My personal best, actually. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. And if your sponsor's not sure they're your sponsor, they're not. And I have a home group. And if you go ever went to Connect the Dots group in Las Vegas, Nevada, I'm proud to be a member of that group. It's a three legacy group. We're into the book, we're into service, we're into the traditions. So we have four open meetings, all solution-based meetings per week, and 14 panels that we take into different treatment centers and detoxes. And I have the privilege of doing three of those a week. And I'm active in that group. I have service commitments, and I have a relationship with a God that I did not want to believe in and that I was afraid of when I got here. You know why I was afraid of him? Because I thought he existed to judge me, and I knew that I would never, ever, ever, ever measure up. That I would never be good enough. And so I came here with an empty house. But I came here broken enough to get a sponsor and start following directions that I didn't think would work, and they changed my life. I want to welcome the new people. Glad you're here. Especially Gal Allison, I think, that got the book. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You won't find another place on the planet that'll give you a roaring applause and a gift for recently burning your life to the ground. I mean, you're not going to get that anywhere. You're not going to get that at the PTA, I'll tell you. Yeah, this is different. Alcoholics Anonymous is different. And if you're new, I encourage you to set aside your opinions and your judgments of everything that's offered here and just go for it. Just say yes. Say yes to sponsorship. Say yes to, you know what the great stuff to say yes to is? The stuff you don't feel like doing. The inconvenience stuff. You know, like putting on a coat and tie tonight. I don't like coat and ties. I feel choked. My sponsor says that it's pretty hard for something to save your life that you're not willing to be inconvenienced by or demonstrate respect for. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. How could you not help love AA if it did in your life and in the lives of the people you've tried to help that have become dear to you? And if AA did that in your life and as it's done it in mine, you couldn't help but fall in love. And it's an inevitable that you will fall in love with anything you serve. And you'll stay in love with anything you serve. That's why people who can't get off the selfish position here have a tough time. Because they don't want to do... Because I almost died of alcoholism because of my own selfishness. And I didn't even know that that's what it was. But selfish, self-centered, self-obsessed people like myself, I only do what I feel like doing. And when you first come into AA and you look at the steps and you look at the commitments and you look at the concept of some dictator sponsor telling you what to do and you look at all that stuff, I don't know anybody that comes in and looks at all that and goes, oh, that looks like that would really work. I mean, it doesn't look that way. It's easier to have an opinion and a judgment about it and then consequently do what your selfishness wants you to do anyway. Not do anything that you don't feel like, because that's what selfish people do. And I know, because for 7 years I relapsed because I was that guy. I was the guy talks about in chapter 5 who doesn't recover, who's dying here. And it says it very clear. It's read to every meeting. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. I didn't even know it, but I was part of that group that exists and has existed in Alcoholics Anonymous since the very beginning. The people that aren't in their way towards the light, they're on their way towards the graveyard. And I was part of that group, didn't know it. Because I have one of those kind of minds that if it forms an opinion on something, I don't even think it's a judgment or an opinion. It's not an opinion if you're right, is it? I mean, right? I mean, and I'm right. And I tell you, I was dying from being right. And the funny thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, we grow from our willingness to be wrong. Nobody grows. We grow backwards from our need to be right. Nobody grows from being right. Because if you grew from being right somewhere, you can bet in our literature it would say, and when we were right, we promptly admitted it. I mean, yeah. So we get smaller. I've accomplished some intermittent, I hate to even use the word connected with me, but intermittent occasional humility as a result of my willingness to be wrong. As my willingness to go make amends to people that I'm convinced really should make amends to me. Right. But my willingness to take those kind of actions, my willingness to be inconvenienced, to take these commitments, to show up an hour and a half before my home group to help, to have a job there, to take these commitments to hospitals and institutions, to intergroup, general service. Really, truly, it's just a matter of surrendering and taking a position where if Alcoholics Anonymous or people in AA ask me to do something and I can do it, my job is to say yes and do it. That means come up here. That means Monday night when I get home, I will. I got a guy that's we're doing his fifth step, and I got a home group meeting Monday night, and I'll show up there dressed appropriately, dressed nicely. An hour and a half to an hour and 15 minutes before the meeting. I'll go out to eat with a bunch of people after the meeting, and I'll bring some of the guys I sponsor because I want them to be connected through their actions to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the steps in and of themselves are wonderful, but it's only one of three legacies, and they're all important. I didn't want to have alcoholism. I don't know why I had alcoholism. You know, my parents weren't alcoholic. They were just wonderful people. They were kind. They were principled. My mother was a therapist, and she got into that when I went to school and she was able to go back to work. She got into that because she wanted to help abused children. My dad was an environmentalist because he wanted to do good in his life. You know, they were all about that. They were real involved in the community. They were wonderful people. They loved me. I could see it. But I'm so self-centered, even as a little kid, I couldn't feel it. Because you can love me, but I'm the black hole of love. You can't love me enough. You know what I'm saying? You can sacrifice for me. You can do for me. You can spend your money on me. You can do all kinds. Put me in and out of treatment centers, pay for therapists, bail bondsmen, lawyers. And it's just like, I don't even thank you, right? It's just like, yeah, what else you got? You know, it's like that entitlement, that of that alcoholic ego. Don't even ever appreciate nothing. That's how selfish and self-centered I am. And I had a childhood burdened with love. I mean, it was like, I remember, in the years I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to my first meeting before I was old enough to take a legal drink. And in those years that I was in and out, I would run into people who had horrific childhoods. I mean, And I've sponsored guys that had childhoods like a bad episode of Criminal Minds. I mean bad. And it's like, this sounds bizarre, but I'll tell you, it's the truth though. I've had moments where I kind of envied them, right? Because they have a reason to be screwed up. You know what I mean? I don't have a reason. But I'm just as screwed up as they are. I have the same difficulties with relationships. I have the same difficulties with jobs. I have the same difficulties with my emotional nature. I am just as prone to feeling like I don't fit as they are. I'm just as prone to low-level depression as they are. And they came from a terrible family childhood, and I came from a wonderful childhood. Because alcoholism doesn't care about any of that. It affects the mega rich, the very poor. I spent some time in India with some people that were very poor, and alcohol, and they're not Christians. They were everybody in the room was Hindu, and they suffer. And when you talk to them on a one-to-one, you'd think they were a guy you grew up with, right? They had the same difficulties fitting, the same awkwardness around people, the same failure at being the guy they wanted to be. And they had the same reaction to alcohol. And I'm an alcoholic for two reasons. One, as an alcoholic, alcohol, especially in the early days, now not at the end, but in the early days of my drinking, it did something for me that it only does for alcoholics. And you'll hear 1,000 descriptions of that magical effect. You know, it's all, you know, made me feel free, took the fear away, allowed me to come out and play, and it made me 7 feet tall, made me bulletproof, maybe, you know, be able to talk to girls, all that stuff. But what did it really do? You could condense it all down into one thing, that it did something for me I didn't understand until I was sober a couple years. It relieved me of the bondage of self. And I didn't even know that I was in the bondage of self. But I felt it and I suffered from it. And when I say I suffered from it, I always suffered from it when I got sober. It's when I got sober that I seemed to just get myself on me. It's when I get sober that I have those feelings that Wilson refers to as a state of anxious apartness. It's when I get sober that I don't feel like I fit. It's when I get sober that I feel so lonely because there's nobody on anywhere that looks the way I feel. There's no one that seems to have the awkwardness around people that I've always secretly felt and kept, tried to keep in the shade. There's no one around me that seems to be like me. And I'm unique, I'm dying, and I'm suffering, and I'm in a state of abstinence. And that is the baffling thing about alcoholism, because I thought it had to do with alcohol, and it does. The litmus test, the other thing that makes me an alcoholic, is that what alcohol did to me. And this is our litmus test. This is what Dr. Silkworth says. If this happens with you, then you're an alcoholic. And this effect, what it does to me, differentiates me and sets me apart as a distinct entity. And what is that? Well, our book refers to it as an allergic reaction to alcohol that manifests itself in a phenomenon of craving, which sounds really good, but if you're new, it probably means you don't even know what that means, right? I mean, it's like, what? I got a DUI. Now I know what that means, right? I lost my job. I know what that means. I throw up a lot. I know what that means. But what's this phenomenon of craving? Well, regardless of what other problems I have, and alcoholics... We're problem magnets, man. I'll tell you, nobody comes in here with only an alcohol problem. I mean, it's just, we attract problems. I mean, if it'll hurt you, we find it. You know what I mean? we're those kind of people. So you might come here and you might have a drug problem, might have a gambling problem, you might have an employment problem, might have family problems, might have relationship problems, might have depression problems, might have anxiety problems. You might have a porno problem until you ended up in the burn unit, for God's sakes. I mean, you can have a lot of problems. But if you're alcoholic, there's one thing in common. There's one thing in common, is that's when I start to drink, as I feel the effect of the alcohol, I'm overwhelmed with a feeling for more. I've always had that. I didn't know it. I couldn't see it when people in the treatment center years, the years I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out of treatment centers and jails, I would hear members of AA talk about this phenomenon of craving, and I don't get it. And I don't get it, and I can't see it, because the way this sickness uses my own mind against me. You see, it's the only disease I know of that if you have it, it will kill you, and your head will facilitate the journey. And you'll never see what's happening to you. You just won't see it. Our book says we're a baffled lot. Yeah. So I couldn't see the phenomenon of craving. And yet, I always had it. A couple little examples of it. At the very end of my drinking, I was unemployable. I mean, I couldn't work. My last job I had, after I lost the job as a therapist, guys like me shouldn't do that. But after I lost that job, the only job I could get until I got sober was a telemarketer, right? Which speaks volumes of my spiritual condition right there. And this was a lot of years ago, before the feds got involved in telemarketing. So we just call people up and lie to them. Just outright lie to them. I used to call people up for selling ads in the Fraternal Order of Police Gazette, right? And I'd call them up as, "This is Officer Conley down here at your state police barracks," you know? You could go to prison for that today, right? I mean, but there was no stuff back then. And I'd call, and I was their best, top, number one salesman. But I had to be drunk to do it. I couldn't do it sober. But you get me about, no, not drunk, but just on my way there, but halfway drunk, I can sell some stuff, I'm telling you. Because I can do it. So one day, my boss comes in. I got a pint of 100 proof Southern Comfort in my coat pocket, right? My boss comes in and he says, with the owner, and he says to me, "Listen, kid, you can't do this anymore. We don't care. We don't care that you're our top salesman. You're a bad example. You can't come in here drinking. You cannot do that. And if you do it one more time, you're out of here." Well, that's bad news, because I need the job. Because without the job, there's no paycheck. Without the paycheck, there's no alcohol. Without the alcohol, man, I am in trouble. And I'm one of those kind of guys that has to have a certain amount of alcohol every, you know, regular, to keep the madness at bay. And so I go home that night, and I'm just, oh man, I got really, really drunk that night, just thinking about him. And I go to work the next morning, and I'm a little shaky, but I'm not going to drink. But I can't. I get on that phone, and when I'm sober, I guess I'm sensitive, because people are rejecting me. Now my sponsor explained to me years later that when I told him I was sensitive, he said, "Sensitive? Aren't sensitive people sensitive to other people's feelings? You're only sensitive to your own. We call that selfish." So because I'm self-sensitive, I'm getting jacked, man. My sponsor has a great saying. He says it's like somebody puts a spring in the pit of your stomach, and life just twists it tighter and tighter. Every rejection just tightens that thing, that knot in my gut up a little bit more. And by about 11 o'clock, a little after 11, I'm like, I'm in despair because I'm not going to get a paycheck if this keeps up, because I'm on commission. And I start thinking to myself, man, this isn't any good. This, because I'm always considerate of others, I thought, it's not even good for the company. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not only not going to get a paycheck, but I'm not making them any money. This is not good. I thought, you know what I'll do? I'll take my lunch hour. I'll go down around the corner. There's this little bar. I'll go down there and I'll have some vodka, because you can't smell vodka. I'll have some vodka, maybe vodka and orange juice. Make it a health drink. You know what I mean? I'll have two, just two. And since I'm only just going to have two doubles with orange juice, right? Two. And then I'll come back to work. That'll be enough to take the edge off. I won't be so uptight. Maybe I can, the patter will flow a little bit. I'll be able to sell some stuff. It seemed like a really good plan. Okay. So I go down to this bar and I'm going to have just two, and I get the first one and I drink it too. I didn't want to drink it this quickly, but I'm like one of those Alpo dogs that they do for the commercials that they haven't fed in 3 weeks, and they put a bowl of dog food in front of them. You know what happens. And I'm that way with this drink because I need a drink. Because my nerves are shot. Throw that double down quick. Got another one coming. And I started trying to sip on the second one. And I'm sipping on the second one. I'm thinking to myself, getting a little aggravated. And I'm thinking, this is the United States of America, for God's sakes. It's a land of freedom. I got constitutional rights. Who are they to tell me I can't drink? I don't pick fights with nobody at work. I'm their best salesman. I don't get out of line. I don't do anything bizarre. I said to the bartenders, do I look like I'm drunk? And I walked up and down in front of the bar. He said, no, you look fine to me. Give me another one. I never made it back to work that day, right? And if you could have put me on a lie detector and said, Bob, were you in the grip of a phenomenon or craving? Didn't look that way to me. You know what it looks like to me? I just changed my mind. I got new information. The decision was made in a moment of weakness. And alcohol did that to me, and it did that to me, and it did that to me, and I never saw it. I saw that I was screwed up. I saw that I'm going to jail occasionally. I saw that I lost another job. I saw the shame of things I did to my family. But I could never see the phenomenon of craving. And it punked me out over and over and over again. And when it says in her book, we're a baffled lot, man, they're not kidding. I don't know what's going on. Now, if the phenomenon of craving for alcohol was the only aspect of this disease, then I suppose as a young kid it wasn't even old enough to take a legal drink in 1971, when you would have told me about this disease, I may have come to my senses and realized, oh, okay. I can't take the first drink. For me to have a drink of alcohol, it's like having sex with a gorilla. You're not done till the gorilla's done. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't mean to be crude, but that's kind of, I can't think of a better way to put it. And so I eventually get to a place where I get that. I get that I must not drink. And I can't do any drugs either. And I start what I thought was going to be the turnaround years. I thought the years where I was going to straighten my life out, where I'm not going to drink no more. I'm not going to burn it to the ground anymore. I'm going to do good now because I'm really, really serious about not touching that stuff. And what actually happened truly was I entered into the most horrific and the most painful years of my life that were so that created so much self-loathing and anguish in my life, I would eventually try to take my own life. Because I don't understand. Once again, I'm a baffled guy because I don't understand how I could be sobbing and swearing to myself, I'll never touch that again. And I'm so sincere and so convicted in staying abstinent that I think I'm never going to go back to it again. And 6 months later, 6 weeks later, 10 months later, I'm back at it again. Do that once, you're an idiot. Do it over and over again, there's some stuff wrong with you. And I started to wonder, what's wrong with me? Because it doesn't look like alcoholism to me. It looks like it must be some kind of psychiatric disorder. It must be some kind of emotional disorder. It must be something like that. And so I started going to my mother, who loved me and was a therapist, and my father had a lot of connections. They got me to see some of the greatest psychiatrists on the planet. I used to go up to on the train up to New York City and do a group and then a therapy session with Albert Ellis. I mean, who was like a legend in those days. And I was in therapy with Dr. Silverman, who studied with Fritz Perls and Alan Watts. I mean, I did so much stuff. I primal screamed. Was hypnotized. Rational emotive therapy, gestalt therapy, transactional analysis. I got my parent and my adult kind of child all kind of worked together, you know. But it didn't do anything for me. You can get all kinds of informational stuff, but I still go back to drinking again. You know, when it says in our book in B, the ABCs, B, that probably no human power could relieve your alcoholism. You don't have to sell me on that. I tried everything. If it came up on the radar and I thought it was going to fix me, man, I took a run at it. But I don't think it's alcoholism, and for a couple reasons. One is that I seem to get very weird the longer I'm not drinking. And I go to these stupid AA meetings, and I hated AA. Oh. It was offensive to me. All the happy, clappy crap. And I, you know, you guys are grateful for everything. Oh, Jesus, stop it. You know, And I could sit in meetings and I could watch you and I could listen to you, and something became very apparent to me. My God, I got a lot of problems. But it's not the same stuff that's wrong with you. Because you quit drinking and look at you. You quit drinking, you're happy. You quit drinking, your relationships work. Your financial and career life soars. I can't keep a job. I suffer from depression, anxiety. And I've gone to the therapist and they've given me treatments for that stuff that work for a little bit. And then whatever they're giving me, the shine wears off of it, and I seem to just recede back into being me again. And if I'm me long enough, you know what happens? I get thirsty. Because those pills that doctor gave me, well, they were fine for a while, but they're not as good as 5 shots of vodka. Right? And I'm that guy. You give me a little bit of relief. Eventually, a little bit of relief is not enough for me. And I keep going back to drinking again. And I don't know what's wrong with me. In 1978, I'd 1977, I was in a treatment center, and I was in an emergency room, and this doctor gave me sewed me up, and I found a pamphlet that was talking about the 7 warning signs of cancer. And I read this pamphlet. It was in a bunch of pamphlets like heart disease and diabetes and stuff. I grabbed it. I was sitting in there waiting for them to just discharge me because they had to wait for the x-rays to come back because I'd hurt myself. And And I came to the, I started to believe that I had a brain tumor. Well, because one of the things it talked about in this pamphlet was intermittent unexplained bleeding, right? And I thought, oh, I throw, sometimes I get dry heaves in the morning, I tear my stomach up and blood comes out. Other times, I've had a couple instances where I'm bleeding out both ends. So I started this fantasy thing. I think about it a lot, that I had this brain tumor. And it kind of explained my life. You know, because I have a lot of nights where I do bizarre stuff and I don't remember doing it. It's the brain tumor. It made perfect sense to me. I go off the handle emotionally, just flip out on people at work for no reason. It's the brain tumor. Why I don't feel like I fit and I have an inability to connect with anyone and I feel so god-awful alone. Well, I have a brain tumor. It explained my whole life. And I just would sit, drink that Richard's Wild Irish Rose, think about that brain tumor. Sometimes I could feel it growing. And I had these fantasies, you know, one of these days they're going to find out. They're going to take me to a cancer ward. They're going to, of course, notify my mother and father, who by this time would not have anything to do with me. They were done with me. And they're going to real, because they think I'm a bum and a loser. They're going to find out about the brain tumor and realize how wrong they'd been about me. And of course, all my ex-girlfriends who thought I was a bum are going to be notified. They'll come flocking to the hospital, properly ashamed of themselves. And so, right, my last year of drinking, I ended up in another detox. And you know how they are, and it's detoxes. Those treatment centers, they give you the, they check your vitals, they do all that stuff. They give you a little interview, some medical guy, and he starts talking about alcoholism. I said, Doc, I got a brain tumor. He looks at me, gives me this weird look, like, because I guess he's used to a lot of wackos, right? You know, weird look, and he says, has that been verified? I said, yes, it has. Well, it was verified by the smartest guy on the planet, me. But so he gets very excited. He sets me up with a whole series of tests, blood tests. They shot dye into me. They put me in a tube. They did all kinds of stuff. And I'm waiting for my redemption. He calls me in. Now I'm about to be right. And they're all about to be wrong. And he calls me in. He says, well, we got your results back. You don't have a brain tumor. You don't have any cancer at all. We could find two things. You have a small ulcer and a small hemorrhoid. And he was happy, because he was, just think, you know, you're not going to die or nothing. Isn't that amazing? I wanted a second opinion, right? I would rather die from a terminal illness and me be right and you be wrong, right? Jeez. But he did say something that stuck with me and it messed me up. He said, kid, you've got alcoholism. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. In the beginning of chapter 3, it says, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I had uncles that were alcoholics. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I'll be anything. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I'll be a drug addict. I mean, some of my hero rock stars that I looked up to were professed drug addicts. That's kind of cool and sexy. I'm in for that. I'll be a mental health case, because if you're a mental health case, you get pills and sympathy. I like both of those. But I don't want to be an alcoholic. I never looked up to anybody who wet their pants on a regular basis. And I have alcoholism, and people who argue with the truth get sick. This doctor said, kid, you're alcoholic, and if you keep drinking, it's going to kill you, but you're a young kid. I was in my 20s. He said, it might take 5 years. And that, not too long after that, I busted out of another treatment center. And I'd been placed in there by the courts, sentenced to 2 years in a state penitentiary, and they stayed the commitment. And I was supposed to stay in there a year, and then it wouldn't be a felony, and it wouldn't be 2 years, it'd be misdemeanor time served. Well, that's a great proposition, except that I can't stay sober a year. and not from a lack of trying. I tried over and over and over again. People, some people in AA make me crazy. They just say things, well, just make up your mind not to drink. I've done that. But it evaporates, doesn't it? The most intensive conviction to never drink gets like smoke on the wind after a while and fades. And I don't, and he said that it's going to kill, it might take 5 years. And I come to in the park on the north side of Pittsburgh, and I'd been crashing in this abandoned building that was part of the projects, and I was dirty, you know, because the place I'm sleeping has been semi-burnt out, and I have to pull a piece of plywood to go in there, and I'm covered with, I'm just dirty. I got hair down to here, and it's like I haven't washed nothing, bathed nothing. I haven't changed my clothes. I got a long beard. I'm dirty. I got stuff in me on my hair. I shake like an old burnout wino. I got sores that don't heal because I don't eat. I'm not against eating. I'm just not going to eat up my drinking money. If I hustle $5 and you give me a choice of a half gallon of Richard's Wild Irish Rose or McDonald's, I'm telling you, McDonald's is going to lose every time with me because I need the medicine more than I need the food. And you don't eat for a while, you get like me, you get sores that don't heal, your gums bleed, I shake uncontrollably. And I'm sitting there and it's horrible. And the most horrible thing about it all, it's not just that I live such a pathetic life. It's not just that I've just broken the hearts of everyone I ever cared about. It's not just that I'm totally alone. It's when my life is at its lowest point and I desperately need the effect, the ease and comfort, the feeling of freedom from my problems that alcohol one time gave me. By now, alcohol's pulled the plug. And now I drink in depression. I drink in, it's pathetic. And I'm coming to in this park and it's pathetic and I'm shaking and I can't even get high anymore. There's nowhere to turn. Even the bag and the bottle's turned on me. There's nowhere to go here. And I started thinking about what that doctor said about if you keep drinking, it'll kill you, but it might take 5 more years. And when I thought about 5 more years like this, something just snapped inside of me, man. I thought, I can't do 5 more days, 5 more weeks of this. I'm done. And I made up my mind to kill myself. And in the idea of killing myself, I found a little bit of relief, like as if maybe death was some kind of new drug or something. You know what I mean? Like a new escape. And maybe I'll find freedom. Maybe I'll find something. I'll tell you what I'll find for sure. It can't be any worse than this. You know, and Janis Joplin sang a song, Bobby McGee, and there's a line in there that says, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Sometimes you get to a place where there's no hope and you got nothing left to lose, and there's those idiots in AA again. All right. And yeah, I've been around AA. By this time, I'd probably been to 150 meetings. Every institution I ever ended up in, every county jail, at the mission, every treatment center, every detox I ever ended up with, they'd make me go to AA. Now, I am not an alcoholic, but it seems that every time I drink, I ended up in rooms where the alcoholics are grouped. I'm not sure what that's about. And I'm an alcoholic. And I went on this bridge to kill myself, and I got out there, and I'm looking down at these railroad tracks along the side of the river, about maybe, I don't know, maybe close to 100 feet below, maybe less. And I'm trying to get ready to throw myself off this bridge and just make it all stop. Just make it stop. And this terror gripped me. And it wasn't the fear of dying. The terror was that maybe this isn't high enough. the terror is, what if I don't die with my luck, and I've not had any good luck, I'll probably end up paralyzed from the neck down. I'll lay in some charity ward. I'll lay there 50 years. Nobody will bring me a drink, and my head will just play the movies of my shame and self-loathing and embarrassment, and I'll lay there for 50 years as my head just grinds me to a pulp. And that broke me, man. That just broke. And if there had been a plaque on that bridge that said 100% of the people who jumped from this spot are dead, I'd have been in the air, man. I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of being me anymore. Our book, there's a place it talks about, and I think this is true for so many of us. Before you ever come to believe in God, before you ever get a sponsor, before you ever even believe AA might work for you, it says we will come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of our life as we had been living it. Oh, man, I believed in that. I lived that. And then it says when you get to that place and you're approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, it says there's nothing left except to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools that the people in AA have been laying at my feet for years, and I kept jumping over them to get what I want because I got stuff left. You know what I got left? Opinions, judgments, ideas. The steps, maybe later, I got to go talk to her, right? I got idea. I know what I need. This is, hey, I'm me. I can't listen to anybody. You can't help me. I'm dying of an ego disorder that I don't believe or know that I have. There was a great psychiatrist in Pennsylvania who was part of the staff on three different treatment centers I ended up in the Pittsburgh area. And the third time I was in treatment, he cornered me and he said something. I never forgot it. It didn't hit me at the time. Later, looking back, I thought it was the most brilliant thing anybody had ever said to me. He said, guys like you don't get any better. He said, some of you find a way to stay abstinent for long periods of time, but you don't get any better. And the reason you don't get any better is even though you have no self-esteem. Now, I don't know how he knew that. Even though you have no self-esteem, you've grown this gigantic ego, and because of that, you have an inability to listen to anyone in order to hear anything new. You're only capable of listening to see how you are already right. And I just thought, that's the stupidest guy I've ever heard. Right? I had to pick him apart because he was threatening me. And that's what I do. In the years I'm in and out, if I go to these, sit in these meetings, you say something that gets to me or gets a little close to me, I'll make you out to be an idiot in my head. I remember this. I was in this treatment center and they had a speaker come in. And I think he was a pretty good speaker. But he started hitting home with me. And I started getting a little squirmy and getting a little uncomfortable. And here's what my head did. I remember looking at him going, guy's stupid. Oh my God, that's the stupidest looking toupee I've ever seen. And with that, I could make him out to be an idiot and a goof and throw out everything he was saying and defend myself against the truth that could have got to me and pierced me. Alcoholism, I think it's the most defended terminal illness on the planet. Cancer patients who are stage four in their terminal, they don't go through a lot of gyrations about to prove to themselves how they're not alcoholics and the doctors are stupid. Right? They don't do that. We do that. People tried to help me for years. You can't help me. I'm too full of myself. And after that failed suicide attempt, I came off that bridge in a state of patheticness that was lower than anything I've ever known before. And I know some low, but this this was, it's not just that I've ruined my life, that everyone I ever cared about and loved won't have anything to do with me. Drinking has become horrible and pathetic and self-pitying, and not drinking feels like I'm doing time and I can't suffer that long. It's on top of all of that, I don't even have what it takes to kill myself. Our book refers to that as a state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. A place where there's nothing left. There's no hope. There's no ideas. There's no excuses. There's no new nothing. I've done it. I've taken all those roads. And I came off that bridge, and little did I know, I was afraid, because I know 2 years in prison are coming at me. I've already missed one appointment with my PO, and I start hitchhiking cross country trying to get to California, because I almost froze to death on the two previous winters. You get thrown out of a halfway house in dead of winter in Pennsylvania or up northeast, and it's 0 degrees out, you got a problem. You know, you go in bathrooms at gas stations and try to sleep a little bit until somebody tells the manager you're in there. He comes in and he kicks you, and he tells you what you are, and you're too weak and you're too sick to defend yourself. And they'll hit you and kick you and they'll throw you out. And same with hallways of apartment buildings. And I thought, man, I get to California, I could survive another winter. I could sleep on the beach. I could get some phony ID so the police wouldn't find me. Maybe I get a job. Maybe I could be a rock star. Right? Hey, if you're going to go big. And I'm going to go to California. I never made it to California. By the time I'm rolling through Las Vegas in a van, some drunks had picked me up in the middle of Missouri. I'm coming through Las Vegas. I got out, and I was so sick. I was at that bad spot. So, you know, they say only I heard somebody say one time, only 5% of the alcoholics get physically addicted to alcohol. Most alcoholics just, they have a terrible problem with alcohol, but they never get that deep in. But I was that guy. I get to these places where if I don't get a certain amount of alcohol in me, I'm in trouble. Sometimes seizures, sometimes I'd feel like I'd lose my mind. I got to get a certain amount of alcohol in me every day. And yet, on a run, you get to a place where you can't keep it down anymore. That's a horrible place to be. You've hustled just enough money for a quarter Richard's Wild Irish Rose, and you drink half of it and it comes back up again. That's the saddest thing to see, is that stuff hitting the ground, man. Because that's potential make me feel a little better medicine, right? And I couldn't keep it down, and I was so sick and I was shaking apart, and a security guard at the federal building who actually helped me get into a detox, and I was really sick. They had me on IVs, and I was in tubes and all kinds of stuff. I was in bad shape. And they got me a set of clothes to wear. Clothes I had on, they had to burn. They gave me clothes to wear out of a bag of clothes that people had left there, right? You know, like, I think I had check pants and a check shirt, and the checks don't match, you know. And I started, after I got physically well enough to get out of that bed, I got started going to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in there. And I met a man who was to become my first sponsor, a guy named Dick. And Dick had been, he's a doer. Dick had been a past delegate. He was one of the guys that started the Las Vegas Roundup, the Las Vegas Retreat, the Thai Club, the Samaritan House. Dick was the first real H&I guy in Las Vegas. He brought a meeting in there twice a week. He was a doer. He was a guy that didn't talk about his primary purpose, helping drunks. He lived it. What an amazing example he was for me. Because he walked it. And I went up to him, and I was scared. I said, would you sponsor me? And if you will, I'll do anything you ask me to do. And that was the moment I became willing to get my life out of the hands of the idiot that had been running it. And we started this journey. And I told him I'd do anything he wants me to do, but my God, people in AA, they want you to do some stuff. I mean, and none of it's a good idea. And, I mean, none of it until after you do it. And then we all say the same thing. Oh, man, I wish I'd have done that years ago. He wanted me to turn myself in and offer to go do 2 years in prison. I thought, oh, no, I don't jail well. That's not good. He convinced me if I didn't do it, I wouldn't stay sober, looking over my shoulder. And I did it, and I didn't have to go do the 2 years. They transferred my case to Nevada, and they gave me some conditions, and if I met those conditions, it would be a misdemeanor. Time served. If not, there's no more chances. It would be a felony in 2 years. And all because I followed his directions, which I didn't believe would work. I think some of us die because we can't push ourselves aside enough to take actions that are not my idea. And that's, we join the ranks of the unsurrendered. And the unsurrendered in Alcoholics Anonymous can stay physically sober for a period of time. But inevitably one of three things happens. They'll start switching to something else, and they'll start getting on some kind of medication. They'll stick a pistol in their mouth and blow their brains out, or they'll return to drinking. Because alcoholism, chronic alcoholism, I'm not talking about a drinking problem. I'm talking about chronic alcoholism demands treatment. In the last 30 days, four people I know with over 20 years of sobriety who that had stopped doing a lot of this, and never bought the whole package, I suspect. Now, the one person who was sober 30-some years had bought package for a while, but somebody that knew them pretty well said that they'd backed away and stopped doing it for a while. But these four people with many years of sobriety took their own lives. I knew the one guy real personal because he was 29 years sober. I sponsored him his first 8 or 9 years of sobriety. He was a great member of AA. Steps, service, everything. He had all three. He was a good member of AA. But he started becoming successful. Started making a lot of money. He started getting popular. He started having a big life. And as he got to a point where he didn't really need me to sponsor him anymore. So he was good. I'm good. I don't really need this. I'm good. Because, he was, I'm sure he looked at me and thought, oh, I'm smarter than that guy. And he didn't need a sponsor anymore. He stopped doing the steps and the 12-step work. And he didn't have a home group anymore. He went to meetings. He only went to meetings where he could share. There's people in my home group has several speaker meetings. There's people in AA that will not go to a speaker meeting. They don't want to go anywhere where they can't share. There's something wrong with that picture. I mean, God gave us two ears and one mouth like he's trying to tell us something. I love speaker meetings because I don't have to worry about saying nothing. I just sit there and let God talk to me. And he does. God speaks through Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a covenant that it refers to in our second tradition about this ultimate authority expressing himself right here in the group. When we come together for the purpose of recovery, there's something in the midst that's greater than the sum of the parts. God's in the midst. But you gotta kind of pull your head out of your butt enough to hear God talk to you in the meeting. You can't be on your phone. You can't be texting. You can't be playing games. You'll miss it. You may miss the one little tidbit of information that'll change your life. That'll change your life. When I was about 4 years sober, I was getting ready to quit my ninth job in 4 years. I'll tell you, that speaks volumes of untreated alcoholism. And I hadn't worked the steps yet, and I mean, I dabbled with them. I did the life story inventory, and then I did another one using the 30-some questions and the 12 steps and 12. I hadn't really done it out of the book yet. And there was a lot of things in AA I didn't, but I was going to a lot of meetings, and I couldn't hold a job. And I ran, I was a DCM, and I was at a PRASA, and the speaker, one of the guys there was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. And I knew Chuck a little bit, not well, but I knew him a little bit, and I'd heard him speak many times. And he said a couple things. I went up to him after a meeting, and because I was paying attention, I could have missed it. If I'd have been in my head, we didn't have cell phones back then, but if we would have had it, I'd probably been on my phone and would have missed it. But he gave me a little piece of information that changed my life financially. I bet you from his little piece of information, I made $10 million. I'm getting ready to quit my ninth job. And I told Chuck about it. I told him how I felt, how they were taking advantage of me and how they wasn't getting paid enough and nobody appreciated me there. And all the symptoms of selfishness, right? And he said, I'll never forget this. He said to me, he said, kid, he said, you got it all wrong. You got to go to work for one reason only. You go there to help God's kids. You go there to be of service. Forget yourself. And I started trying to do that. It was funny how I could hear that. I could hear it because I was getting ready to go to my 10th job. You know what I was afraid of? I was afraid that I'm just going to feel like I'm doing time every time I go to work. There were people in AA that were happy about their jobs. I was not one of them. I was afraid I'll never stay anywhere long enough to get like medical insurance and stuff. I'll never get benefits. And because I was scared, Chuck's message met my self-centered fear, and I bought what he said, and I started to do what he was talking about. And changed my life. Changed in no time at all. I ran the business that I was working at. It led to another deal with a past employer to become a partner. And I just went to work for one reason and one reason only, and that was to help God's kids. And my life took off. It was unbelievable. And I got to a point probably close to 20 years ago. I was a young kid. Everybody said, I wanted to retire. I said to myself, you know, I just want to do a lot of AA. And I'm a songwriter, and I want to do some of that on the side. But I just want to do a lot of AA. I want to have more time to take guys through the steps. I want to have more time to do H&I. I want to have more time to be involved in a home group. I want to do more AA. And I retired. I was young. I mean, and I remember retiring thinking to myself, well, if I get bored or depressed because I don't have enough to do, I'll go back to work. My life's so full, I don't understand how I used to work. AA filled up every little corner of my life. I mean, it's just from the minute I wake up to when I go to sleep, it's all AA. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what it's done in my life. I think above all, I love the freedom. There's only one freedom. And I think it contains all freedoms. And it's freedom from the bondage of self. And if you don't have that, you're missing it. Thanks for listening.